Thoughts work for our advantage or disadvantage according to their nature. So here, this is a very interesting statement. You know, we could read over this and not pay much attention. Thoughts work for our disadvantage or our advantage or disadvantage according to their nature. He didn't say according to our nature, according to their nature. So now he's saying, you're not your thoughts. Your thoughts are independent of who we've identified as self. And if we can grab them, and through the help of the elementals, we can have a little more knowledge of oneself. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because we think and think and think, and then we believe that that's who we are. But here, this is, he's saying, it's a, we are not necessarily what we're thinking. Who said that? Was it Plato, Aristotle, I think, therefore, I don't know, which one was it?
Somebody? Descartes.
Descartes, okay. Thank you. The Sufi creates, fashions, and controls thoughts.
Can you say that again?
The Sufi creates, fashions, and controls thoughts. The Sufi drills them and rules them throughout life. They form an army and carry out one's desires.
Wow.
Why isn't everyone here trying to figure this one out? This is like the best stuff going. I know. And by the way, this book is for sale after class. Yeah, is this amazing?
It kind of almost seems like, and maybe I'm just not hearing it right, but it's kind of almost contradicts itself. First, it's like the thought is like, you know, it, and we just kind of hang on for the ride. And then in this next sentence, it's like, no, we're the, you know.
No, he's saying in the first one, we are not our thoughts, but they can be, if we're not aware of them, we can be totally controlled by that thinking. And we also have, you know, in another text, he talks about the lines of the mind, that we have this tendency. I mean, this is, and this is why there are all these books and why the people are flocking to all these books on creative thought. Because it's true. They have found out that it is, the brain is still so reptilian in a way. I mean, as human beings, we think we're highly creative and really in charge and free-willed and freewheeling. But the truth is that our brain is really designed to do a task and do it repetitively. And this is why people have trouble with kind of getting out of the norm of thinking that they're in, and why they're embracing sort of new thought to help almost trick the thoughts from going through this repetitive pattern, you know, because just it's in our species and that's how we survived. We did certain things and we did them well repetitively, but we have the tendency to do that again and again, even to our demise. Right? You know, there's those, that great Buddhist story about the hole in the ground. You know, you walk down the street, you fall in the hole. You walk down the street, you know, you see the hole, you fall in it anyway. You walk down, you know, you get to the fifth time, and it's like, well, just walk down another street. Why do you keep walking down the same street? Or just go walk around it, you know. You don't have to keep walking in the same. So it's kind of that story, and we've all heard that story. But the point is that, here he's saying, you know, you can almost like look at them as entities. He's saying they are entities and they're controlled by the elemental world, and you can kind of, you know, you can not fall into that line in the mind. You can pick up, you know, he used the analogy many years ago of the phonograph needle. We saw that when it was scratched, you know, and we do that in our own minds, and it's like pick up the needle and just move it to the next spot.
We really miss the music, don't we?
Yes, we do. And that's why this book, The Mysticism of the Sound, is so good, because we want to connect with that music of the spheres that Murshid was talking about in that first reading. So again, I will read it. Thoughts work for our advantage or disadvantage according to their nature. The Sufi creates, fashions, and controls thoughts. The Sufi drills them and rules them throughout life. They form an army and carry out one's desires. As the germs constitute our physical being, and the elementals are mental, so do the angels constitute our spiritual existence.
That's reminiscent of the secret and abundant thinking. The army, create an army that carry out your desire, the thoughts. By holding those thoughts, the desire is carried out. It's not even an action, but it happens as a result of holding the thought.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they say form follows thought. Vibrations, as a rule, have their length as well as their breadth, and they may last the least fraction of a moment or the greater part of the age of the universe. Yes.
I have a comment from Roger. I think of purification practices, example, Mundro practice. After months and years of this practice, one has created a sense of purity. And I think of the child who is always told how stupid or ugly, etc. And over time, the thoughts have negative consequences on the person.
Is there a question or just a statement?
A statement.
Thank you. Well, I love that saying, and some of you have heard it. Some of us have even done it as a practice at Sufi camp, where my grandmother, my mother's here with us, and her mother was known to be quite extraordinarily beautiful. She was almost like movie star beautiful, right, Mom? And we've come to really appreciate her and say, you know, I called her Ann because she didn't look like her grandma. She never looked like her grandma, so I always called her by her first name, Ann. And we would say, well, how many times do we say mom in a week? Yeah, Ann was right. And when I remember one time I asked her, I said to her, Ann, why are you so beautiful? And she said, do you really want to know? And Roger, this is relating to your comment, because this is a woman that had 9 other brothers and sisters and often felt marginalized in her life, and she pulled herself up by her bootstraps, so to speak. That's what Murshida Vira would tell us to do. You're going to lay around feeling sorry for yourself, or you're going to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You know what General Patton used to say, when the going get tough, the tough get going. So anyway, that was a little bit of Murshida Vira, my first initiator and teacher. But Anne said to me, I'll show you. And she took me into where she had her vanity. And it's funny because they call that a vanity, isn't it? With the mirror and the, you know. But anyway, it was the little dresser with the mirror. And she said, and she put her hand under her chin, and she looked in the mirror at herself. And she said, I tell myself every day, I love you and you're beautiful. I love you and you're beautiful. She said that to herself, looking in the mirror. She didn't wait for somebody else to say, I love you and you're beautiful. She told herself. And, you know, wherever she was, everyone treated her at least with respect, and they did think she was beautiful.
We had a picture, and she had red hair, freckles, green eyes, and my other aunt, she was the third one in the family, and, you know, all the rest of them, my aunt, other aunts were beautiful and this and that. And then she said, you know, they get my aunt, you know, go down and get the... And then they ended up, she'd end up, she tells a story about them buying her reddish-orange coat with her bright red hair. But I got to tell you, it must have worked, because when we were having a picture, a print that she'd had you know, something she had when she was in San Francisco, because we wanted for the memorial for her, what do we call it, the visitation campus. And then we went to get a frame for it. And when we kept carrying that frame, and then we had them frame it, carrying it through the store, they wanted to know who it was a picture of. And we kept saying, it's my mother. But they thought that it was some movie star in that picture. Everybody in the store. That's what they kept saying, didn't they? Mm-hmm. They said, well, we thought it looked like so-and-so. I said, it's my mother. And they thought she was some, they thought we just bought the picture with a movie star in it. Mm-hmm. So she came up from, I guess it worked, I don't know.
Well, she seemed pretty, like she was a very, she was a happy person, and she always had made people happy. She did a lot of, she brought people around her and made them feel happy too.
Always like to be around her.
So that's the point, is that, you know, she replaced those impressions where she was marginalized, or because, you know, her family, I mean, she was born in Italy, and, you know, there were times where people were very discriminated against as being Italian, you know, and she pulled herself up out of all of that, you know, and raised mom alone. She was widowed when she was very young and functioned as a career woman in the 30s, and, you know, so nothing's impossible. She didn't wait for someone to do that for. She did it for herself. She controlled her thoughts, you know. And she never much felt sorry for herself, I can say that.
She never cried. She never said, oh, this or that. I never saw her crying.
It was a really
she
good
cried
example.
She cried for sadness, but she never cried. Oh, I didn't. Not me.
Miss Crybaby over there. But you're also a very strong mother, so I appreciate everything you've done. So I'm going to go back to the text here on the silent life. Again, it's from the mysticism of sound. And it relates, again, deeper. Now we're going deeper into this aspect of vibration, and we'll be coming soon to this practice of working with the elements. And also, please feel free to ask questions or comments along the way. So, from the mysticism of sound, the section called the silent life. There are two aspects of vibrations, fine and gross, both containing varied degrees. Some are perceived by the soul, some by the mind, and some by the eyes. Shall I read that again?
Yes.
Okay. There are two aspects of vibration, fine and gross, both containing varied degrees. Some are perceived by the soul, some by the mind, and some by the eyes. What the soul perceives are the vibrations of the feelings. What the mind conceives, he uses what the soul perceives. With mind, he uses the word conceives. What the mind conceives are the vibrations of the thoughts. What the eyes see are the vibrations solidified from their ethereal state and turned into atoms which appear in the physical world. Here. Now, this is a person who English isn't a first language, and he really has it. Perceives, conceives, sees. Do you see that transition? Now, here it goes, and I'll read the whole thing once again when I'm finished, but it's not done yet. He says, which appears in the physical world, constituting the elements, ether, air, fire, water, and earth. The finest vibrations are imperceptible, even to the soul. The soul itself is formed of these vibrations. It is their activity which makes it conscious. Wow. To me, we could study this paragraph probably the rest of our lives. That is profound and very full. Shall I read it again?
Yes.
There are two aspects of vibration, fine and gross, both containing varied degrees. Some are perceived by the soul, some by the mind, and some by the eyes. What the soul perceives are the vibrations of the feelings. What the mind conceives are the vibrations of the thoughts. What the eyes see are the vibrations solidified from their ethereal state and turned into atoms, which appear in the physical world, constituting the elements ether, air, fire, water, and earth. The finest vibrations are imperceptible even to the soul. The soul itself is formed from these vibrations and their activity, which makes it conscious. Creation begins with the activity of consciousness, and that was also said in the previous paper, the Muir Reads paper. And it was also even in this first reading from his personal notes. Creation begins with the activity of consciousness, which may be called vibration, and every vibration starting from the original source is the same. Okay? Every vibration starting from the original source is the same. It's all the same. It's just a matter of how it vibrates that we become individuated in this way. Every vibration starting from the original source is the same, differing only in its tone and rhythm, caused by a greater or lesser degree of force behind it. So that force is kind of what pushes, you know, gives it some life from that original source down through the elemental scale. It's a very, you know, I'm sorry for people that say, oh, now we're going to do the elemental breaths again. But you can see how much more there is behind breathe in the nose and out the nose, in the nose and out the nose, in the nose, and, you know. I mean, my God, this whole, it's like, here she goes again, those elemental breaths. But are you getting a little peek here? I mean, there's so much. That's why I'm saying, yes, they can be done mechanically and there is some benefit. But if one can go deeper into it and study it in a vaster way, one becomes, well, the whole universe starts to become revealed through this one practice alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, I want to go back to this part about when the soul perceives. What the soul perceives are vibrations of the feelings. What the mind conceives, so conceives, something's constructed in the mind. You see, Murshid, in another part of the teachings, in the Sufi Message volumes, talks about the fact that he talks about this more and more subtle way of being in the world and how thoughts are so much more fine, excuse me, feelings are so much more fine than thoughts. And so the idea of constructing a thought is a much harsher thing than the delicacy of perceiving a feeling. You understand that? And then, of course, the grossest one of them all is, again, the eyes. This is something that has become solidified from the ethereal realm. You know, seeing is believing. Well, maybe it's not, maybe not. Maybe not. You know, maybe feeling is believing. I mean, how many times have we been, we you know, again, in these experiments of visual perception, we can often be fooled at what we're looking at. We think we're looking at something, and it's entirely something else, yes? Or someone can be saying something to us, but we have a very different feeling than what's being said, yes? In one of the teachings at summer school, there was it was actually the paper on mysticism, and Murshid was talking about how, and paraphrasing, and Kabri, you read the paper, so I'm sure you studied it very deeply, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but he was talking about, through our practices, through the path, that sometimes clairaudience or clairvoyance can be developed. And that often people want those, to develop those insights. But he gives this example of he himself had started to develop these finer perceptions. And out of respect for quite some time, he didn't mention it to his teacher. But when he did mention to his teacher said, "I'm very sorry." And he was saying, what reasonable person would really want to know the future or to really know everything that's in other people's minds? I mean, it's just, we barely can function with what we know, you know, or think we know, you know, and that it can be so overwhelming, or even to have the sense that the demise of someone that we care about is, you know, near. You know, how does one has to be very developed inwardly and spiritually to be able to cope with that. And so he was talking about treading on that path very carefully. But still, we have it. We know we have it. We have those, we have feelings, we have intuitions that come more or less and are more or less accurate. You know, we can test that over time as that develops. But it's not something to play with, that's for sure. It can be very shocking. Yes?
Question from Roman Zubin. What do you think the ears can? Can the ears also feel what people mean?
I do think that, I think they can, but I think it's also for each person. You can often hear in someone's breath what's being said, or also it's that aspect, I'm sure you both know the attribute Basir. No, sorry, not Basir. Sami. Yes, the hearer of all. So sometimes you can hear without even someone saying something. Mm-hmm. Is that not true? Mm-hmm. And Zubin and Rama, you also know that, yes?
Would you like to turn your microphone on?
Yes, turn your microphone on so we can hear you.
They wrote in that, yes, that is what I mean.
Yes. I think the mystic can hear, it's hearing with the heart or hearing with the soul. It's not always hearing with the ears. Again, someone can be saying all the nice things in the world, but there couldn't be poison in that. You understand what I mean? I think people know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to appear cynical, but we should be wise. It's not cynical. It's the truth. It's just the way it is. And until we're all enlightened, and we really wish for everyone else to be enlightened before we ourselves are enlightened, we're willing to sacrifice that ourselves in that way, it's just a fact of life. And that's where understanding and loving in the midst of hardship comes.
Alim and Alima, like knowing the reason behind the reason?
There is that beautiful saying, it's from, who is it? Ibn Arabi says, seek to grasp. The word is grasp, the translation is grasp. That which is transpiring behind that which appears. seek to grasp that which is transpiring behind that which appears. Did that answer that, Alima and Alima? You can unmute and speak if you'd like. It's easier.
You know what? It's not coming through clear. Go ahead and write it.
Sorry, I think it's so many people are on the line. Also, watch yourself right now. Did your mind just go there? Are you still here? Where's your breath? You can see, you can follow the breath. Watch what's happening in the room when we have some activity here. It's such a revealing thing. Did we stay here and let it come to us, or we... Do you see that? Do you feel it? It's very interesting. And from a Buddhist philosophical point of view, that's grasping. This is one of the reasons we suffer. Or we say, oh, we don't want that machine here, you know, the aversion also. And we have the something from Alima and Alima. Are we moving on? Back and just read a few more these sentences again. Is there something?
Yes. Does the soul do the grasping?
No. No, now we've used that word, haven't we? I used to even a Robbie, the two different interpretations of grasping, perhaps. I think this is my sense of things. And, you know, I'm just one person, so other people in the room or other people online may have some input. The soul is like a clear lake, or when the ocean is very still and everything is reflected as it really is in it. There's no grasping, there's no interpretation, there's no extrapolation, there's no translation. It's what is. And it arises in that way. Does that make sense? It's very simple and it's very natural. And there's no figuring it out. It's just what is.
So, real grasping is knowing?
Let's take away the word grasping. It's isness. It's thatness. It's suchness. And if those terms are abstract, just hold them till you come to understand what those mean. Creation begins with the activity of consciousness. Creation begins with the activity of consciousness, which may be called vibration. And every vibration, starting from its original source, is the same, differing only in its tone and rhythm, caused by a greater or lesser degree of force behind it. On the plane of sound, vibration causes diversity of tone, and in the world of atoms, diversity of color. It is by massing together that vibrations become audible, but at each step towards the surface, they multiply, and as they advance, they materialize. Sound gives to the consciousness an evidence of its existence. Sound gives to the consciousness an evidence of its existence, although it is, in fact, the active part of consciousness itself which turns into sound. The knower, so to speak, Alim and Alima, the knower, so to speak, becomes known to the self. The knower, so to speak, becomes known to the self. In other words, the consciousness bears witness to its own voice. It's a very beautiful, but it's also very subtle here what's being said. Because he said in one part, consciousness all comes from the same source. Then he's saying, the knower knows its own voice. Do you see what I'm saying? And therefore we know ourself, which means we know, come to know God. Is that like totally profound or what? I mean, is anyone else like feeling like, wow? I mean, is everybody else excited about this or am I the only one? Can I drag you along with me if you're not? How about the people at a distance? Are you feeling this? Don't know, they're silent. The knower, so to speak, becomes known to the self. In other words, the consciousness bears witness to its own voice. It is therefore that sound appeals to humanity. All things being derived from and formed vibration, formed of vibrations, have sound hidden within them, as fire is hidden in flint. And each atom of the universe confesses by its tone, my soul origin is sound. If any solid body is struck, it will answer back, I am sound. So he's given us, it's just so beautiful. Sound has its birth, death, sex, form, planet, God, color, childhood, youth, and age. But that volume of sound, which is in the abstract, beyond the sphere of the concrete, is the origin and basis of all sound. The origin and basis of all sound. This is the Nada Brahma. This is the primordial sound. This is the celestial sphere. It's all coming from there. Both sound and color make their effect on the human soul according to the law of harmony. To a fine soul, color appeals. To a still finer soul, sound. Tone has either warm or a cold effect according to its element. It's true, yes, different instruments have that sound too. And we hear it sometimes, the shrill in a violin or this warm and bracing sound, depending on how an instrument is struck. It has a warmer, cool tone to it. Tone has either a warm or cold effect according to its element, since all elements are made of differing degrees of vibration. Therefore, sound can be produced and can produce an agreeable or disagreeable effect upon the human mind and body, and has its healing effect in the absence of herbs and drugs, which also have their origin in vibrations. Therefore, sound can produce an agreeable or disagreeable effect upon the human mind and body, and has its healing effect in the absence of herbs and drugs, and which also have their origin in vibrations. So this is, I mean, first of all, the sounds of nature, would we all agree, are very soothing to us. They're very healing to us. But there are also certain musical formations that perhaps have an appeal. And this is very important. We know that they've done those experiments with sound and vibration and words to look at the water formations as they've gotten frozen and crystallized. And the ones that are listening to this heavy metal are not such beautiful formations, but ones that have more harmonious sound that's been projected into them create beautiful symmetrical, you know, patterns. And so if we think about that and all of our body, how much of it is comprised of fluid even, the idea of bringing in these sounds into the atmosphere is very important for healing and health and balance in all realms, but here he's really giving us a strong indication of that. And one of the things that I know Pure Merchant Diet even prescribes is that zikr of Hazar Benayat Kohar. Mm. Being very balancing, being very harmonizing, being very healing. And there's a paper that I'll share that somewhere, I think when I come to Columbia for the workshop, on zikr, and he talks about that, how using these sounds, how they can totally change our internal environment. And what's more, can produce an effect within us that can actually help others as well. And it's just about that zikr, specifically.
Classical music has that reputation also, especially yes. Mozart.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, one of my mentors in college, was Victor Papanek, studied and worked with Frank Lloyd Wright, the great American architect. And he said that they were never, ever, they worked in the studio together, and in the studio they were only allowed to play classical music because of that reason. That Frank Lloyd Wright felt very strongly that even compositions, which all of us may like, but jazz and things were sometimes very erratic and harsh, you know, and that he felt that the work that they were doing as architects needed to be very harmonious and beautiful and sort of support the forms of nature, which he did. I mean, his work always did that.
And on things Sirkar said in dance was that another study has shown that dissonant music seems to kill cancer cells. I mean, even they want something beautiful, I guess.
Yeah.
Just kind of odd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I am not familiar with that study.
I'd like to find out more about that.
Well, there was something in another one of the papers that we read at summer school, and it was, the title of that paper was The Universe in Man. And there was a short story in that paper that I thought was important, and I'll share it now, because Mercia talks about that there are things in our body that we may not have, but by thinking of them, we can actually produce them. And he gave an example of a man who had a disease of the blood, and that he had something missing in his blood, and the doctors would inject him with it, and for a short period of time there was a result, but over the long haul there was no long-lasting result. But the man kept thinking about the necessity of needing this component in his blood so much so that in the end his own body started to produce it. So it does have its effect. So it's a catchy thing, you know. Does repetitive thought in that regard serve us? Yes. And that's where Murshid was saying the Sufi grabs their thoughts, creates their thoughts, and uses them as their his army, but he or she is not a victim of the thought. So watch the thoughts. That's also very good, very, very much a Buddhist practice, watching one's thought. And in the Sufi tradition, we use, you know, concentration, contemplation, and meditation. That's the path. It's not unlike what we would do in our Buddhist practices. So we're very close now to start to read about the elements, but I have one more paragraph, and then we'll go more deeply into the elements and the practice. And we'll conclude the class with our prayers, and that will be the class for the day. But we have some ways to go. Can you stick with me? Manifestations, being formed of vibrations. The planets are the primal manifestation, each planet having its special tone. Now here he's talking a little bit about, you know, you maybe have studied Pythagoras and the symphony of the spheres. Or this is not unlike what happens, what we witness when there really should be the number of dervishes in the dervish turning as there are planets. This is reenacting the cosmology of the universe, you see. Really should not be too many more, shouldn't be less. Things could start to wobble in our Milky Way. But the point is that the planets do have their own, we can see that, and they're beginning to hear that too. Their rotation indicates a kind of sound. And if you, in time, those of you that work deeply with the practice, if you don't already, you will start to hear. Sometimes you'll think, oh, I'm hearing every sound that was ever made in the whole universe. Don't let it drive you crazy. It's a blessing. It's there if you listen. Everyone has the capacity to hear that. It's just a matter of tuning and training. So manifestations being formed of vibrations. The planets are the primal manifestations, each planet having its own special tone. Therefore, every note represents one planet. Every individual, therefore, has a particular note to oneself, which is according to one's birth planet. For this reason, a certain tone appeals to a particular person according to the grade of one's evolution. Every element has a sound particular to itself. In the finer elements, the circle of sound expands, and the grosser elements, it narrows.
Say that again.
Every element has a particular sound to itself. In the finer elements, the circle of sound expands. In the grosser elements, it narrows or it constricts. It is therefore distinct in the former and indistinct in the latter.